Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. In this episode, we talk to
Claire Qualman.
I'm Gail Burton.
And I'm Serena Corder.
And together you are
Walk, Walk, Walk.
Walk, Walk, Walk are an artist collaborative that describe themselves as an archaeology of the familiar and the forgotten. The interview opens with Serena Corder talking about walking and Gail Burton about their particular focus.
Walking belongs to everyone, and for that reason it's free. Anyone can do what we're doing, but we are artists as well, and we have a particular way of looking at what we're doing that maybe not everyone has.
The focus of our walking has always been on spaces that we feel are overlooked. So it's those spaces that afford a gap in the city, which gives us the freedom to reimagine those spaces in a way that functions for us. So rather than being dictated to by very planned functional uses of space, of how you're supposed to shop or move or relate to the city, we've been naturally drawn to those spaces that are less clear in their use. And so even looking at our routine walks and the meanderings around those, we had a commonality of spaces that were perhaps a bit grotty or a bit dangerous or a bit dark off the back streets. And that really has been the kernel of excitement and possibility for us. And the route that we defined through those spaces of abandonment or overlookedness has proved to be an exciting one for other people too.
For all of us, walking, although we very much wouldn't deny that we enjoy it, began from a necessity. It's like, it's not that you're saving money by not going on the bus, it's that if you don't have the money for the bus, you can't save the money by not going on the bus. It's the kind of requirement of surviving in a city that's very expensive, and there's a real freedom in the knowing that you can walk somewhere, because you don't have to worry about have you got enough money to get back, or all of those kind of things that are really important when you're kind of really living on a fine line in terms of monetary requirements. It's kind of constructing an alternative possibility for living in a space.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's kind of what the night walk's about too, in some ways. Yeah. It's taking other people and constructing an experience for people that's outside of the normal possibilities of the city.
I suppose at the beginning it was, as we say, it's about our routine walks, but it's about kind of re-exploring, and it's about exploration, I guess. And that was the joy at the beginning, of sort of giving yourself time to re-explore this route you've done every day, and what may have seemed mundane, but then to really go on that walk with a really different headspace and a really different attitude to the way you were looking at things and the way you were observing things.
It's like if you psychologically step aside from the day-to-day routine, you can examine something in a whole new light.
It's a very interesting and quite strange experience, and I think it has its most pronounced example in the night walks. When we do these re-routines with groups of other people that we take on the night walks, maybe 15, maybe 30, maybe 75 people, we have a train of walkers following behind us, and we three walk at the front, keeping a pace which allows people to keep up with us, but which is still our pace. And somehow, through having that group of people with us, it kind of makes a passage through the city and through the route in a way that, being on your own, you don't have, because you have to be aware of safety and navigating other people and your day-to-day routine. And you're kind of freed from all of that by being in this group. And places in particular, like Weaver's Fields, which usually are desolate, foggy, sometimes full of screaming voices, really quite can be quite frightening, you're suddenly free to look at it in a way that you can't usually because of all the other stuff. My memory of some of the, what, 6 or 7 night walks we've done is of being in Weaver's Fields and actually seeing the buildings at a distance, hearing the sounds on the other side of the field, just hearing voices and having this kind of free flow of thoughts and sensations that are just not possible in the same way when you're actually in the routine.
That is quite an interesting point. It's funny to think back to when we were getting ready to do... Well, no, we weren't even thinking in terms of taking other people on a night walk yet, but we decided that we wanted to walk the route at night just ourselves in order to see how kind of different it was. And we were absolutely terrified. It must have only been a few weeks later that we went out fly posting some... We'd written a series of kind of stories about the walk and encounters on the walk and turn them into posters that we went out and fly posted. And that sort of transformation of, I think it, we sort of discussed it quite a lot, didn't we? Yeah. How it changed that when we were just out walking, we assumed that all of the other people in the space must be bad and out to get us because we were good and we were just walking through it. Yet when we were fly posting, we were bad, and so we assumed everybody else would be good and out to get us, and then we felt fine. We weren't scared at all.
It's been really interesting to us how by intervening in the city and acting upon it, we can change the way it acts upon us, and it changes the psychology of the spaces that we inhabit. Another really important example for us is the fire stop. About halfway along the route, we always stop and we have a fire which we have set up in an empty oil drum. And the space that we put that fire is the most grotty, abandoned...
It's an undesigned space. It's like the bit of land that's left when the railway has cut off a street.
But and it's in the middle of this strange space that we have the fire, and instead of being the sort of mugging territory, it suddenly becomes a warm, magic, safe, our place.
That sort of unused space or undesigned space has a freedom in it.
It's been important to have them later to really almost exaggerate the psychology of the spaces. So we're interested in overlooked or slightly dangerous or edgier spaces. That really comes out at night. So we want darkness as much as possible.
The first one was on the winter solstice in 2005. The summer solstice is an obvious choice as well. And then whenever we can. I don't know, I felt really strongly that we should walk it, keep walking it, even if it's very occasionally, just because it's such a sort of powerful way to observe and mark a shift in a very particular place. Even if we do new walks elsewhere or create new routes.
Well, there's the challenge of getting through that space.
Yeah, you know, I still want to come back to it and see what's happening and how it's changing. And the back of the map too, the list on the back of the map is things on the walk. And, you know, this time when we came to edit it, the section that's things that have gone was huge, and it made us realise, because actually it had been a year since we'd done a night walk on our old route, just how much had really changed.
You also talked about this fabulous idea of walking around the chip shops. Were the chip shops on your route, or is this a completely different project and I'm confused?
We were asked to make a piece of work for a group show called E8 and decided we needed a slightly new methodology for getting to know this area if we were going to make a walk of it. And we came up with the idea of navigating our way around by seeking out chip shops. And our results led us to devise a walk which went from chip shop to chip shop.
It sort of threw up this sort of history of
of chip shops and the sense that the chip shop was in demise, especially in this area due to the demographic and what people wanted to be eating.
The kind of mixtures of cuisines, I suppose, were quite interesting too, although we limited ourselves to real chip shops, fat chips cut from real potatoes.
How did you go about preparing it? Did you visit every chip shop?
Yeah, yes, every Friday for about 6 months. Very appropriately. We began by buying a portion of chips and walking with it, eating them, and trying to find another chip shop before they ran out, or just seeing where it took us to.
Leaving our mark a bit more in terms of making the chip shop papers, which came out of the project, which were the map. On the night, each of the chip shops actually wrapped the chips in this paper. For the next couple of days, we did see our chip papers sort of floating around.
Strewn around the borough.
The chip shops really became a starting point for us to get to know about the history and culture of chip eating. So it became about much more than just the area in E8, but about people's memories and associations to do with the chip shops and eating chips. And we researched very carefully the history of chips and fish and selling and serving chips. It became very important to us to get to know the people in the chip shops and find out from them the way they felt about the chips. And this formed the basis for some of the stories that we recorded on our chip papers, as well as stories that were submitted by the public or people that we met along the way. About half of the chip shops still had 1960s formica
ranges,
which is the proper name for the contraption that cooks and displays the fish and the chips. These places and this type of food just has such a place in people's memories and affections, and we found that people really, really connected with the idea of the fish and chip shop.
It's extremely nostalgic. I mean, it just, when you mention it, everyone has a memory of a chip shop, and everyone thinks that their chip shop is the best.
One of the things about the chip shops is they're unlike other fast food joints in that they're run by somebody. Regional variations that really started to come out as we gathered stories about fish and chip shops. So as a methodology for devising walks in other places, places that we don't know so well, we would really like to replicate this. And so things like pea fritters or deep fried pies and other regional variations would be really a useful way to get some purchase on other areas. Part of the inspiration for why we picked on chip shops was to do with chip for. When we were performing in Camden, we really had to ascertain what the origin of this chip fork was. I did an experiment to try to work out which chip shop it was from. I walked to three chip shops in the vicinity, one by one, and at each I bought a portion of chips and walked at a moderate eating pace from the chip shop to the place where I knew the fork had been found. And then when I got there, I had to work out if I would have discarded my chip fork at that point. So had I finished my chips? Through that method, I found out which chip shop the chips must have been bought at. So it was the measure of a walk, and we used that when we were devising the new walk in E8.
Forks was, it was something that triggered it,
that related,
made a
it.
Connection to that experiment that Gail just recounted. But right. I think it was also, we were really, there was something about reintroducing new rubbish into the space.
That's
and
right.
We didn't quite know how to do that, but because we'd seen quite a lot of chip forks and we'd had this previous experience with the chip fork,
well, I think it was the idea of how we'd asked people, and we ourselves had collected found objects, rubbish from the streets, to start our kind of archive and archaeology, and sort of wondering if we could somehow become a part of that, if walk 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 ephemera might become the rubbish that other people would then collect. The rubbish of today is the archaeology of tomorrow.
It's like being the bad people again. And to be able to make your mark on the city in that way, to say, okay, I'm going to discard my chip fork, or we're going to create chip wrappings in the knowledge that they're going to become rubbish. You do have to invert the way that you're supposed to relate as a good citizen to the city.
But it's the art object that's the anti-art object, really.
It was funny, I met a woman in a gallery while the project was going on, and I was chatting to her about what I did, and I was telling her about the project, and she was like, oh my god, do you have them in Faulkner's? And I'm like, yeah we do actually. She's like, I knew I shouldn't have thrown that away, I knew that was something special. She's had chips from Faulkner's with them wrapped in, and she was saying, no, I'm going to go, but I think it's in the recycling bin still, I'm going to go and fish it out.
But nobody had told her it was art, so she
so she threw it away because it didn't have the right labels on it. On the night of the chip shop tour, I think I did manage to get chip poisoning.
We definitely could have gone on
we
with
loved
that
the chips. I loved the chips.
Yeah, you could do that nationally.
In this episode, you've heard from artist collaborative Walk, 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 Gail Burton, Serena Corder and Claire Coleman. If you have any views on the interview or on any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Please follow the links on the talkingwalking.net website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking.